Welcome to Augmented Humanity. Our guests are modern explorers working at the intersection of technology and the humanities. They help us to understand ourselves and the worlds we create in this digital age. They are thinkers, creators, makers, and academics working in diverse fields like history, the visual arts, communications, and comparative religion. I'm your host, Craig Goldsmith.
I'm your host, Ellen Dornan.
On this program, we're joined by the artists behind There Must Be Other Names for the River, Dylan McLaughlin, Marisa DeMarco, and Jessica Zeglin. This online art installation, hosted by the University of New Mexico Art Museum, guides visitors along the length of the Rio Grande, where they hear the songs of singers emerging from points along its 1,800-mile length.
I wanted to ask you about the role of grief in your piece, because I know personally my experience was it took me 4 tries to get past the 90s, because as soon as the voices start dropping out, you can feel that river drying up. But the thing that really hit me was realizing that you all had been doing this over this arc of the pandemic, and that you've had your own personal losses as a part of this project. Would you all mind talking a little bit about the emotional roller coaster of working with this material and visualizing into the future and working in a time of great loss?
I think that a lot of people have a really emotional reaction to the piece when it's performed live. We heard from a lot of folks after the performances who said that they would see the years and they would think, oh, that's when my children were born, or that's when my grandfather died, or that's when I moved to New Mexico. Like, because the years are displayed on the wall as we move through the piece, you can see each year and note the ones that have relationship with you, which I think further strengthens that time and place memory, right? And that's great. Like, I love that the piece is drawing that for people, like making that really personal connection. You know, I'd say that the piece for me starts in kind of a grief about the river itself. I've always lived next to this river. I've always lived in Albuquerque. I've been in the river and on the river, like most of my 40 years on this planet, right? And so the day that so much riverbed was just dry and had plants in it because it hadn't been wet in a long time, right? Like, you see the plants start to grow up where there's supposed to be water. It really was like a sudden grief, right? And you're right that in the pandemic, a lot of people are going to the river to celebrate sometimes, or to just be outside, or to run, or just get out of their house. But I think we also are going there to process other things that we're going through. I personally have been down there a lot to process grief. So it starts to hold these other emotional resonances. And I bet more people than just me are down at the river doing that work. And I think the other kind of nice thing about it, though, is that when we had to make this piece virtual, is we were thinking about how the river is connective, in the sense that even if we're not able to see each other, it's connecting us to our neighbors who are up and downstream from us all the time. The river, for me, feels like the through line. It's a thing that is nourishing us all who live along its stretch.
Dylan, you have that video up with an interview with Laura Paskus talking about what's going on with the river environmentally, that also has that really powerful drone video of the dry riverbed along so much of its length.
Yeah, so the video that you can find on our about page on othernamesfortheriver.com is a piece that we all collectively decided that we wanted to include as kind of part of the conversation. There's a few things that inform the question you just asked. One is that credit is absolutely due to Kevin Maestas, who gathered that drone footage. The journalism and sort of conversations, Laura Paskus is an environmental news journalist who's been generating and adding to and exploring these conversations specifically around the Rio Grande for a while now. And so a lot of the framework of this piece itself is kind of really based in the news journalism of Laura Paskus. But the conversation itself that we had with Laura Paskus, it's like the reason we sort of frame this as a conversation on the riverbed there, as we did, as you see in the video, is that it's such a complex unraveling of a story. And there's so many different access points to how we can connect with this project in itself, to the issues themselves, to the different places themselves. There's so many physical access points. It's like the conversation is so dynamic that some of what we're talking about goes very deep for a lot of people. People are very familiar with like, oh, I know that water. I've swam in that water. I've eaten out of that water. And some people are like, oh, I hardly ever see it. I see it in passing over the bridges, yet I live right next to it. It's like, we can't simplify those conversations. It's so wildly complex. And so that video piece that you're asking about just sort of emerged from, let's provide an additional connecting element to that.
And I want to jump in too on the issue of grief, because I've been trying to reflect on this question of what is the role of grief in this particular piece or in any sort of artwork where we're talking about climate change or systemic racism or all of these sometimes seemingly huge issues that we're bearing the brunt of every day. And I think the word complex is really relevant because some people might have a more visceral experience of the river in their everyday life than others. I think one of the strengths of this piece is that it does make that visceral connection through sound between our own bodies and the body of the river. And this sense of grief really comes from a sense of love, right? You only feel grief for something that you treasure and that you feel you have a relationship to. And I think we want to highlight and hopefully deepen that relationship through this piece. But speaking just for me, at the same time, I don't want people to feel immobilized by that grief. I want you to be able to feel the importance of this entity, but for that grief to also transform into a sense of urgency and a sense of hope and possibility. When you start to move into the possible futures, you can imagine a future where the river dries up entirely, or you can imagine all kinds of other futures where maybe we let the river flood again, maybe it stops being an international border, maybe we create different agricultural systems to interact with it differently. So I think along with that grief, we also have to have this hope and this imagination, and I hope that folks experience all of that through this piece.
Jessica, someone described to me recently that grief is love with nowhere to go. And that at the time really struck me as being accurate because it is love. Grief is love still. But I think as we think of this piece, yeah, we want to note, we want to observe and bear witness to a loss. But then how do you also shift that into directing your love, basically? How do you take the grief and the love and channel it into work to save or to fix or replenish something that is feeding us all?
I think especially with something that happens essentially in a kind of slow motion, you know, like we were talking about in the first segment, these changes don't happen in one day, like some kinds of changes that we experience. It's stuff that's happening over time. Like you were saying, Marisa, you've watched these changes happen in slow motion over your entire life, which is also my way of kind of coming back to deep time. You used that phrase in our first segment. Could you sort of maybe expand on that a little bit? Like when you say deep time, what does that mean for you as a group or for each of you in terms of this project? I feel like it's a phrase I should have heard before, but I haven't.
Oh, that's a good question. I think it probably means different things to different people, right? And so I'll also leave time for other folks to respond. But I think for me, deep time is considering the layers of time that we exist within. There is the present moment in which we're operating right now, but there are all of the histories that this land contains and that the people who live on this land live out every day and that the river contains. And as Marisa was describing in the first segment, the river started forming 5 million years ago, right? It became something like what it is maybe 1 million years ago. And trying to conceive of that and kind of place yourself within this larger realm of time, how have we interacted with this landscape over these millennia? Then how can we interact into the future?
I think deep time is Nina Elder's concept for the work she was doing at the University of New Mexico with all different kinds of classes. It's kind of a big enough framework that it could encapsulate lots of different thoughts about time and experience, right? One way that I was thinking about it, which is relevant to this moment, is time stretching. In the pandemic, we are losing time. I don't mean that we're like running out of time or something, but we're like losing track of time in this new way where the days Monday through Friday don't have the same meaning. Like the work week doesn't have the same meaning. Staying up late or getting up early, everything is different for us all with time. So that's one of the wildest things about the pandemic. And then working on this piece for 2 years is it's like, yeah, it was 2 years, but I don't even know what 2 years is anymore. Sometimes I think of something, it feels like it happened a really long time ago and it was like yesterday, but yesterday feels really far away from me right now. There's just a lot of different ways to think about time and time stretching. And then I think what it means to think into the future, especially as we're thinking ecologically and environmentally, like if you consider 50 years inside of a million years, which is the river's lifespan, this is a very sudden injury, even though it unfolded very slowly for me because my experience of time is as a little human. So 50 years feels like a long time for me. But if you're thinking about it from the quote-unquote perspective of the river, 50 years is like a sudden wound or a sudden harm. It's not long. Also, we found that researchers don't project the future for this river out more than a couple hundred years. Not because they're anticipating it will end, but that's just as far as they've gone.
Just listening to the colleagues and collaborators here, Marisa and Jessica, it's kind of constantly illustrating just how we all connect to this work from very similar and very diverse points of view. I think that in itself is also kind of the simple prompt to this whole work. It's storytelling, it's connective, it's about processing, it's about, you know, reconnecting and re-exploring and connecting to other perspectives and scales of time. I mean, at one point you had asked, why have the music piece itself move through annually? Why every year like that? On one level, it seems a little bit obvious. Well, it's like that's how we've kind of mapped and framed time, you know, year by year. But maybe a little bit more of a deeper conceptual meaning of that is because of the possibilities for a connection that can take place when we provide all that opportunity. Even just the visual language of seeing those dates and being able to connect with it with our own material, our own stories, our own celebrations, our own grieving, our own trauma, our own healing, our own births, our own deaths. That's one of the ways that we all kind of share our experience of time. It's loaded. That's what some of those references are for us in this piece that are kind of quite simply us being like, well, these are some containers where a lot of complexity can happen. You know, improvisation is a container where a lot of complexity can happen. Experimental graphic scores are containers where a lot of complexity can happen. Thinking about deep time is a container and so on. Projecting into the future is an incredible container where a lot of complexity can happen. And it's different when we're thinking about an imagined future. It's different than looking back into the past because we just don't have the same kind of references. We don't have the same kind of stories about the future. And yet maybe they're possible. And yet maybe we really could design with the future in mind. Maybe we really could tell stories with the future in mind. In some ways, it's a stretch that we're kind of saying, let's imagine 2,000 years into the future. And in other ways, it's not that of a difficult or complex thing to do. In fact, I think we could normalize it by talking about it more often. I'm not going to be an author or actor that's going to be making physical changes to the river. But there are other ways that our presence, our culture, our society, our stories really will have a big impact 2,000 years from now. And so there's some interesting openings, possibilities that can happen in that space of projected future. And it's not as abstract as it might sound. And it's not that far removed from our experiences right now as it might sound. It might feel really foreign and abstract because it kind of is, but at the same time, it's really like 2,000 years from now is going to happen.
Whether we're here or not.
Whether we're here or not, it's going to happen. And so that's really interesting territory, I feel like.
I think Dylan just completely nailed it. And I think it's also maybe part of why working on this piece in this time that has felt so frozen has maybe actually been really good for me as an individual, and maybe also for the people who experience the piece. Because yeah, we're frozen, we're losing time, we're out of sync, things feel weird and time feels weird, but 2,000 years in the future is coming, right? And so that's maybe something to hold on to, you know?
Just remarkable. Marisa, Jessica, Dylan, thank you so much for being with us today to talk about this project. We really, really appreciate it. And if you would like to learn more about this particular project in all its various incarnations, you can visit the website, othernamesfortheriver.com. Augmented Humanity is a program of the New Mexico Humanities Council, produced in partnership with KUNM-FM. You can visit us online and find out more about our programs at nmhumanities.org. Our theme music comes courtesy James Whiten, and we've had production assistance from Tristan Klum.